This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Pope Francis told young people Sunday not to be afraid to put their lives on the line for others during the coronavirus pandemic. This during his Palm Sunday Mass delivered by live stream from a deserted church and not in front of crowds in St. Peter's Square. The Pope told his followers to look at the real heroes to come to light in these days. They are not famous, rich, and successful people. Rather, they are those who are giving themselves in order to serve others. The Palm Sunday address launches Easter week, the official start of the Catholic world's Holy Week, which ends next Sunday on Easter Day. But the Vatican is refraining from public celebrations, and many of the world's 1.3 billion Catholics are observing the sacred days under home confinement, just like the 83-year-old pontiff himself. In a rare speech slated for Sunday night, the Queen of England is expected to stress the value of self-discipline and resolve during the coronavirus pandemic, this according to the BBC. She's expected to acknowledge the grief, pain, and financial difficulties Britons are facing during this time of disruption. She will also thank Britain's National Health Service staff and workers and emphasize the important role individuals can play. Europeans have suffered especially hard during the pandemic, yet there's some hope. Sunday, Spain marked its third consecutive day of declines in deaths, which now stand at over 12,400. 774 deaths were reported Sunday, a fall of 135 from Saturday. Spain, with more than 100,026 cases, may extend its nationwide lockdown by two more weeks. And Italy has seen its first drop in the number of patients in intensive care during the outbreak. The number of new deaths last reported has taken the country's death toll to more than 15,000, but it is smaller than in previous days. This is VOA News. Global deaths from the COVID-19 pandemic stand at more than 65,000 people worldwide, and there are more than 1.2 million confirmed cases across the globe since the virus first emerged in China in December. Roughly 25% of the world's confirmed COVID-19 cases have been reported in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins University figures on Sunday. New York is the U.S. state hardest hit, where the virus has claimed more than 3,500 lives. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo believes his state is roughly 7 days away from the apex of the virus, but U.S. President Donald Trump warned Americans that there's going to be a lot of death in the next 2 weeks. The death toll in the U.S. surpassed 8,400, and the number of infections rose above 312,000. Asian Americans are using social media to organize and fight back against racially motivated attacks during the coronavirus pandemic. A string of racist run-ins in the last 2 weeks has given rise to hashtags and online forums to report hate. The FBI predicts attacks will increase as infections grow. Critics say President Donald Trump made things worse by calling COVID-19 the Chinese virus. He later said Asian Americans shouldn't be blamed. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said Sunday that low-risk economic activities would resume starting April 11th in a country battered hard by the coronavirus outbreak, but he did not specify what type of activities would be affected. Schools and universities, as well as religious and social centers, will remain closed, and travel between cities is forbidden until at least April 18th. The death toll increased to over 3,600 Sunday, with more than 58,200 cases, according to the Ministry of Health. Iran was one of the first countries to report a large outbreak of the virus, and many experts believe the true death toll is much higher than official figures. 17 medical workers at Egypt's main cancer hospital have tested positive for the coronavirus and are now in quarantine, according to an Associated Press report. The director of Cairo's National Cancer Institute says all the health workers at the facility will be tested for the virus. There are more than 1,000 confirmed cases in Egypt. And Ethiopia has reported its first COVID-19 death, a 60-year-old woman in treatment at a hospital since March 31st. The country's health minister says Ethiopia has a total of 43 confirmed cases of the disease. Via remote from Washington, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
If you go on the streets or even on the social media, you see a lot of people have applauded the president. I think a lot of people didn't expect such cross-cutting measures to be implemented by the administration to cushion the economy and to make sure that people are protected.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika and his government take a pay cut in a move to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
Everyone knows we didn't have even 20% of the population who went to vote. What the president is doing, it's using the security forces to arrest, harass, and to intimidate Guineans.
Guinean opposition groups vow to continue to resist government's efforts to amend the constitution.
The government has an obligation to implement appropriate measures to ensure the protection of women and children from all forms of violence. And the government has to increase support for services and protection, including shelters, hotlines, online advice platforms.
And Amnesty International calls on the Nigerian government to ensure security agencies do not abuse citizens. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has cut his salary and directed senior government officials to do the same. In a statement released Saturday, the president directed the Treasury to cut down his salary and that of his government by 10% for the next 3 months. The funds will be set aside to help fight the spread of the coronavirus. Authorities say the country has officially recorded 4 cases of the disease in the last few days. The president also announced economic incentives to help cushion the possible impact the disease could have on the economy. To learn more about the president's directive, I reach Ngemi Kalilani, spokesperson for President Arthur Peter Mutharika.
His Excellency, the president has directed the Treasury to implement a reduction with immediate effect of salary for himself and the cabinet ministers. The president has said with effect from this month, the Treasury should deduct 10% from his salary and those of the cabinet ministers and deputy ministers, and that all those monies should be channeled to a special financial vehicle that has been created to collect all resources required to fight the coronavirus. Apart from that, the president has directed that the government should recruit more than 2,000 extra health workers immediately that will be deployed at various posts in the country. The move it is aimed at enhancing service delivery in terms of managing the crisis. Apart from these measures, the president has also directed that there should be a waiver immediately on all non-resident taxpayers on expats that are working in Malawi. These include foreign nationals that are working in Malawi as doctors or other medical specialists. From effective today, they are not supposed to pay any non-resident tax. The president has also directed that the Treasury should release money, about 15 billion Malawi kwacha, to be made available as soft loans to the youth in the country. The president has also directed that there should be an increase of 50% to the allowance that health workers with foundational problems get when they work in the civil service.
What other directive did the president give regarding the economy?
Further than that, on the economy, the president has directed that the Reserve Bank of Malawi should talk to money borrowers from them, from the private sector, to give them a waiver so that they are able to pay their loans, having restructured them so that the loans can take much longer to pay in light with the threat that is being posed by the coronavirus. And the president has also directed that the fuel prices be reduced forthwith. And he has directed the Malawi Energy Regulatory Authority to effect the reduction immediately. Actually, as we speak, the fuel has been reduced significantly effective last night when His Excellency the President spoke.
Ngemi, how are Malawians reacting to this initiative and directive from the president?
Well, there is a lot of relief on the faces of Malawians. If you go on the streets or even on the social media, you see a lot of people have applauded the president. I think a lot of people didn't expect such cross-cutting measures to be implemented by the administration to cushion the economy and to make sure that people are protected. And the president has made it very clear that he will not allow any trader, any business person to make profit out of the suffering of Malawians in relation to the coronavirus. And he has also instructed the Fair Trading Commission to make sure that it is policing all traders to make sure that there is no undue profit making from the coronavirus threat. But all in all, Malawians are very excited. People on both ends of the economy have been accommodated in the new measures. Yeah, as indicated, people from all ends of the economy have been accommodated. The private sector has been accommodated. It has been given waivers and a lot of breathers. The central bank has been ordered to make sure that it is cushioning the foreign currency reserves for the country to make sure that there is no shortage. And even the reduction on the fuel has relieved a lot of people, because suddenly the bus fares went up last week because there was a directive that the seating capacity of public vehicles was to be reduced. So the decision by the president to have the fuel pump prices reduced has excited both the commuters and the people that use the public buses.
Ngemi Kalilani is the spokesperson for Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. Opponents of the amendment of the Guinean Constitution say they plan on meeting to come up with strategies to oppose President Alpha Conde. The groups, including opposition political parties and civil society groups, say they will continue to pressure the government to step down. Their remarks come after the Constitutional Court confirmed the results of the recent referendum. The constitutional amendment will enable incumbent President Conde to seek 2 6-year terms in office. But opponents boycotted the poll, saying it was illegal and vowed to thwart the process. Results released by the Electoral Commission show a majority of voters approve the measure. To learn more about the reaction to the referendum, I reach Attorney Thieno Suleimani Baldi, a member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution and president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law.
This is not a surprise. We were expecting that the Constitutional Court will confirm the result given by the Electoral Commission, since everyone knows how this court has been functioning since its members removed the former president, Khalifa Sall, who was independent from any order given by the president. But the current members, they do whatever the president tells them to do. So this is not a surprise for us. In any case, they can confirm the result, but this constitution wouldn't be applied in Guinea. We will do whatever we can legally to make sure the 10,000 constitution still apply.
What's the next line of action for the opposition and civil society groups now that it has been confirmed, the results that is, by the Constitutional Court? What recourse do you have?
The FNDC members will hold several meetings the next days to discuss and find out what strategy will be made in order to keep the struggle. But keep in mind, in principle, with the coronavirus, the idea should be to put off all of political discussion and to focus how to combat this disease. But the president, he is taking advantage of the disease right now and go ahead with his idea to put in place a new National Assembly and also to implement the new constitution. But in the coming days, there will be discussion between all of the FNDC members and to find out the way to go forward.
What do you say to supporters of the president who are saying the opposition and civil society groups are just making noise and that it is unstoppable since majority of Guineans supported the referendum amendment, which basically will enable the president to seek additional terms?
We all have seen how these elections were organized last Sunday, March 22nd. Everyone knows we didn't have even 20% of the population who went to vote. What the president is doing, it's using the security forces to arrest, harass, and to intimidate Guineans. And he's hoping he will succeed by doing so to keep quiet on any kind of opposition. It won't happen. We know for sure the people around him and the elite, they don't want to give up the power. Since they have endless resources through corruption, but once again, the best important things today is to find how to fight the coronavirus, save the life of Guineans. And we are trying to prioritize that objective right now. We will see how we will deal both with the coronavirus, but at the same time, not just let him go ahead and finalize his objective to run for third term.
Atenu Thieno Sulemani Balde is a member of the opposition coalition group, the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, and president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. In Nigeria, Amnesty International is calling on the government to ensure that security agencies do not abuse citizens. The rights group says security forces, including the police, must respect the rights of citizens as they enforce the two-week lockdown imposed by President Muhammadu Buhari. The government says the restriction is meant to help curb the spread of the coronavirus. Amnesty International's remarks follow report of security operatives beating civilians. Sheung Bakari, Programs Manager for Amnesty International Nigeria, says there appears to be an increase in gender-based violence across the country following the restriction. He tells me that the Nigerian government must ensure that security forces remain professional as they enforce the crackdown.
We have made a number of calls to the Nigerian authorities, and our first call is that the Nigerian authorities must adopt a right-respecting approach and must give clear instructions to security agencies not to abuse their powers as the nation tightens its effort to tame the COVID-19 pandemic, which, of course, as we all know, has compelled the authorities to impose lockdown and interstate movement restrictions around the country. We have also said that the national response to the COVID-19 must be inclusive to ensure that prisoners, internally displaced persons, and other marginalized and vulnerable communities are not left out of any of the stages of the fight against the virus.
Well, Sheung, some civil society groups and opposition groups have said the response of the government must be inclusive to ensure that prisoners, internally displaced persons, as well as those marginalized and vulnerable communities be part of any stages of the fight against the virus. Officials say they are doing just that. What is your organization's reaction to this?
The evidence that we have gathered and the reports we are getting from the field do not show that the authorities are indeed addressing the need of the most vulnerable in our society. So, for example, we know that there have been unrest in, for instance, the Kaduna Correctional Center a few days ago. And this unrest was triggered by the reported death of a prisoner. And of course, this triggered panic among other inmates about the spread of the COVID-19. We also know that not so much has been done in internally displaced camps. We also know, again, that many detainees in police and military facilities across Nigeria are at risk of contracting COVID-19, as they are all held in overcrowded and unhygienic conditions that can even be more deadly in the hot weather. So we are concerned by the reports that we have been getting from the field, including reports of heightened domestic violence and gender-based violence against women and violence against children at this time. So our call has been that the government must not only lock down, but must also be alive to its responsibilities to understand that in these difficult times, certain persons are at more risk than others, and these persons, their needs must be addressed urgently.
Talking about agency, I understand your organization is also calling on the government to implement transparent income support programs. Officials of the government say that there's ample evidence to show that the government has been distributing a lot of money to the less fortunate in society so they can buy foodstuff ahead of the lockdown. And even during the lockdown, things have been made available for those vulnerable in society. What is your reaction to that?
When the government makes these claims, what we find most times is that there are no evidence on ground to support these claims. The government claimed that it's been transferring money to the most vulnerable in the society, the poor families. The question is, what yardstick has the government used to determine these poor families? And it looks to us that these claims are all lies, because we've seen people starting to protest on social media, for example, and making claims that hunger is their greatest need at this time. So the evidence on ground do not support the claim by the government that it has taken care of the poorest persons within our society. In fact, we know, as a matter of fact, that the provisions that, for instance, the Lagos state government has been making has been grossly inadequate. So we know, for example, that the Lagos state government has provided food to a number of households. But in a situation where, for instance, there are 100 households and the government has only provided a few bags of rice that could only, for instance, satisfy the needs of 2 or 3 households out of 100 households, the question is, are these provisions then sufficient? And that's the Lagos state government. We don't know exactly what the federal government is doing. So the point is that what the government is saying do not necessarily match or correspond with what is happening on ground. The reports that we are getting do not support the claims that people have received, for instance, cash and money from the government or any kind of support from the government at this time. And you must understand, and I think the government also has to understand, that if we want to prevent or stop people from going out, we have to, as a matter of urgency, as it is being done in other countries around the world, we have to make provisions so that people are not forced, as a result of their conditions, to go out during this lockdown, because then it will defeat the whole essence of asking people to stay indoors. Governments owe a duty to provide sufficient access to services so that people can survive at this time. And these services include health services and, you know, provision of, for instance, emergency shelter for people who need it, provision for homeless people, including children in streets. These people deserve to be protected. These people deserve some kind of support from the government, and they cannot be left to cater for themselves at this time when the entire situation around the country is very difficult.
Seun Bakare is the program's manager for Amnesty International Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. A new report released by Afrobarometer shows a majority of Africans experience shortages of much-needed medical care. Respondents say health is one of the most significant national problems they want their government to resolve. Many lack access to medical care or have to pay bribes for service. The report comes ahead of World Health Day scheduled for April 7. For more about the report, I reach Gugu Nonjingi, a spokesperson for Afrobarometer.
Afrobarometer conducted the survey in 34 African countries, and we did about 45,000 interviews between 2016 and September 2018. More than anything, these are Africans' experience. even before the COVID-19 pandemic in Africa that we're currently seeing right now. And these are experiences that show that majority of Africans say that more than half of them actually say that they've experienced lack of needed health care between those 2 years. And these are findings that we've only, I mean, there are countries, various country differences between the 34 countries.
With the shortage of healthcare, as the respondents expressed concern about, how are these respective countries going to handle the pandemic of COVID-19 or the coronavirus situation currently infecting a lot of countries at the moment?
More than anything, health ranks second amongst the most important national problems that our Africans, or other Africans, have ranked that they want their governments to address, which of course, it, by the Afrobarometer data, it ranks second, just after unemployment. I think more than anything, citizens are concerned about the quality of healthcare in their countries, but I do trust that African governments are doing their level best when it comes to addressing this issue. As I mentioned, this data was collected between 2016 and 2018, before we had this pandemic outbreak in Africa. And between 2018 and now, various strides in respective countries have been made to provide better healthcare, as government is currently reporting. But it's just a matter of making sure that these data is taken into consideration when government is providing healthcare services to address such issues in their respective countries, and of course bottling down to respective communities and what is it that they deserve.
Well, Gugu, what were the responses of the respondents regarding the performances of their respective government in healthcare delivery? Because I understand that in some cases, because of the difficulty in accessing them, some of them have to pay bribe in order to access needed healthcare.
So among those who pretty much went to find medical care, or even sought medical care during the previous year, meaning between the period of 2016 and 2018, about 1 in 8 Africans, which is about 13%, said they had to pay a bribe, as you've just mentioned, or rather give a gift or do a favor to get the care they needed. More than anything, fully half, which is 50% of patients, reported paying a bribe in Sierra Leone, followed by Liberia at 43%. And bribery, we've noted in Afrobarometer that bribery for medical care was also least common in countries like Botswana, Mauritius, and Eswatini. Overall, we picked up, or rather citizens noted, that they are rating government a bit negatively. And we found that governments are receiving a bit of mixed scores for their performance improving basic health services. On average, about 51%, which is close to half, of Africans say that their governments are doing fairly well or very well, which is a really great feedback from citizens. But also, almost as many, around 46%, rated them as performing fairly or very badly. In some countries, we've picked up there is an overwhelming majority who've approved government's efforts, including countries like Eswatini, Botswana, around 83% and 72% of citizens saying this, respectively. Countries who've been rated the least are countries like Morocco, Sudan, around 18 and 27%, respectively. So in as much as citizens are saying that they have to do some sort of bribery paying or other gift giving to officials in order to access medical care, we must take into note the positive responses that we're receiving, that if it's still a majority that are saying that their governments are doing very well and fairly well when it comes to providing healthcare services.
Was the overall objective of this survey established?
Yes, definitely. I would like to think so, because the main objective for the Afrobarometer is to give a citizen and the ordinary citizen voice, right? And as a nonpartisan survey research network, we aim to provide reliable data on African experiences and evaluations on areas around democracy governance, or even areas around the quality of life. So this survey, or rather this question on healthcare, is one that was taken out of a number of questions that the Afrobarometer asks citizens when we conducting the surveys across these countries. So the objective of giving the ordinary African voice has been achieved by the Afrobarometer, with hopes that this data will be utilized by respective government officials or even NGO organizations that seek to answer to these experiences, or rather to correct some of these perceptions, or rather even experiences and evaluations that are provided by the African citizen.
Gugu Nonjinge is a spokesperson for Afrobarometer. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, the UN Refugee Agency warns thousands of refugees and migrants detained in substandard facilities in Libya are threatened by COVID-19 and ongoing conflict, and they should be released. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The military offensive launched by renegade commander Khalifa Haftar in the Libyan capital Tripoli a year ago continues unabated despite the threats posed by the COVID-19 pandemic. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 300 civilians have been killed and 150,000 others displaced by the fighting. In addition to this threat, the UNHCR says Libyan authorities have confirmed 10 cases of COVID-19 and one death. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balash says the country's weakened health services are unable to adequately respond to this pandemic.
The ongoing conflict has severely impacted the country's health system and medical services, which have limited financial resources and face shortages of basic equipment and medicines. Many hospitals or health facilities located in the areas close to the conflict have also been damaged or closed.
Balash says daily life is becoming increasingly difficult for people across conflict-torn Libya. He says they have difficulty accessing basic goods and services and finding work. He says house rentals, food, and fuel prices are soaring, making them unaffordable for many. But he notes those most at risk in this unstable, war-torn society are the thousands of asylum seekers and refugees held in detention. He says the UNHCR and other agencies are calling for their orderly release.
Asylum seekers and refugees held in detention because they do not have legal documentation are particularly vulnerable and exposed, given often poor sanitation facilities, limited health services, and overcrowded conditions. Many detention centers are also located in areas close to the fighting front lines.
Balash says the UNHCR continues to provide protection and assistance to refugees, asylum seekers, forcibly displaced Libyans, and returnees. But he adds deteriorating conditions and lack of security in the country are hampering the delivery of aid to those in need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Anyone who has followed closely the exchange of views between Ethiopia and Egypt regarding the functioning of the Grand Renaissance Dam would not have been surprised that Ethiopia had decided to delay its attendance in the last phase of the negotiations in Washington, D.C. From the very beginning, Egypt criticized the construction of the Grand Dam on the basis that Egypt needs 95% of the Nile water to survive, and that 80% of that flows from the distributed the Blue Nile, which flows through Ethiopia. Ethiopia had given full assurance to Egypt that the operation of the dam would not in any way affect the flow of Nile water to Egypt. Nevertheless, Egypt has always insisted that Ethiopia and Egypt should negotiate, and Ethiopia had agreed. But Ethiopia had rejected proposal by Egypt that third parties should participate in the negotiation to resolve difficult technical issues. So it was a great surprise when Ethiopia accepted the good offices offer made by the United States and joined in a negotiation with Egypt and the Sudan. The U.S. in turn convinced the party to bring in the World Bank to provide the usual technical assistance to resolve those difficult technical issues. Egypt wants Ethiopia to stretch the time within which it will fill the Grand Renaissance Dam. Ethiopia, on the other hand, wants the shortest period of time to fill the dam. So this was the impasse that was to be resolved by the good offices extended by the United States. Now, behind the scenes, there was those who were worried as to why Ethiopia had agreed to use the good offices of the United States, particularly after the United States published its Palestinian plan. There were discussions that the United States could not be seen as an honest broker. And perhaps Ethiopia, throughout these talks, may have detected that the plan that should have been presented to the parties at the end of February was one which would not be completely harmonious with its interest. The first hint about this came when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed paid a visit to South Africa. He then called on President Ramaphosa, who was becoming the new chairman of the African Union, that he should pay some interest in the issue of the Grand Renaissance Dam. Now, the response of the Ethiopians when they announced was very strange in a sense. One of the announcements was that Ethiopia would never accept any terms that would be contrary to its fundamental interest. But another said that the reason why Ethiopia was not going to the meeting was because it had not yet completed all its negotiations. The Egyptians have not yet made any comments, perhaps because of the death and funeral of former President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. And the Americans have also not made any comments. In the meantime, it will be prudent for the African Union to begin to examine whether or not it could play a role to promote an agreement on the modalities that could enable the Grand Renaissance Dam to start functioning. This will be a contribution that the African Union could make, either alone or joining the mediating role in Washington along with Sudan, Egypt, Ethiopia, and the United States and World Bank. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent.
You.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English Service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how beautiful and well-crafted a coffin might look, it will not make anyone wish for death. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.